This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now, your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guests on Off the Shelf are Jason Workmaster. Jason is a partner at McKenna Long & Aldridge, LLP, and David Dowd. David is a partner at Mayer Brown, LLP. Guys, welcome to the show.
Hi, Roger. It's good to be here.
Yeah, Jason, it's great to talk to you. And David?
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Roger.
Well, today our topic of conversation is one that is of interest to or should be of interest to all government contractors in terms of one of the rules out there, or pieces of legislation, statute that you could need run afoul of, and that's the Civil False Claims Act. And actually, the Coalition for Government Procurement is going to be hosting a forum on the Civil False Claims Act at the Tower Club in Tyson's Corner on April 18th. It's a breakfast forum. It'll be starting around 8:30, and David and Jason are going to be on a panel, as well as Marsha Madsen from Mayer Brown LLP, and Jack Horan from McKenna Long & Aldridge, Chris Mead from London & Mead, Relators Council, and we have invited representatives from the Department of Justice who handle Civil False Claims Act litigation, and we're waiting to get a confirmation on that. So I'm looking forward to that forum, and I think, just to start the conversation, Jason, can you tell us, what is the Civil False Claims Act, and give us some of the history on it?
Sure, absolutely. And the history is actually quite a lengthy one now. It goes back to the Civil War and a concern during, at that time, that there was fraud occurring in the government's procurement of material needed to support the Union war effort. And so the Civil False Claims Act was enacted, as often still sometimes referred to as the Lincoln Law. And it's become the government, over the course of time, with some amendments taking place over the course of that history, it's become the government's primary statutory tool for fighting fraud, and in a variety of contexts. Most of these cases actually are in the Medicaid-type context. And what makes it important to establish right here at the outset, in talking about this, we're talking about the Civil False Claims Act. It's not a criminal statute. There is a Criminal False Claims Act, and just for our listeners out there, the primary difference between a criminal statute and a civil statute is the penalty that attaches to a violation. A criminal statute that comes with handcuffs and jail time. Civil, the penalty that attaches to the violation of a civil statute is a monetary damages, and then there are also monetary penalties associated with a Civil False Claims Act violation. The primary differences, one of the reasons the government uses the Civil False Claims Act to the extent it does, and it distinguishes it from a criminal, the criminal Civil False Claims Act. To show a criminal violation, the government has to show that the defendant meant to defraud the government, set out to lie, cheat, steal. They don't have to make that showing with the Civil False Claims Act. All they have to show under the Civil False Claims Act is that the defendant acted with reckless disregard for the truth, or with deliberate ignorance of the truth when it was submitting its bills to the government.
It's not a question. It's a question of intent, right? On the criminal statute, it's like you have a plan. You intended to defraud the government. And in the Civil False Claims Act arena, it's almost analogous, I guess, to sort of rising the level of negligence to the point, reckless disregard.
Yes, and the courts really have struggled with that over the course of time, exactly what is reckless disregard. And, you know, some of the courts have said things like, you know, well, it's gross negligence plus. Well, you know, exactly what does that mean? And so it's just, you know, it's when it comes down to it, it's a question of proof, and it's just, it's a lot easier for the government. It's a much easier standard to meet, reckless disregard or deliberate ignorance, than it is actually, you know, prove that someone meant to defraud the government. So that's one key difference between the criminal statute and the civil statute. Another key difference for defendants is that if you're at the wrong end of a criminal False Claims Act case, the government is bringing that case. The Department of Justice is bringing that case, necessarily so. With the Civil False Claims Act, the government can bring those actions on its own. But there's also a provision called the Key Tam provision of the Civil False Claims Act that allows private parties to bring these cases in the name of the government. These folks are, the technical term for these folks is relators. You'll sometimes hear them called whistleblowers. And they'll bring the action in the name of the government. And why you know, what's the incentive to do that? Well, if there's a settlement or if the litigation goes forward and the defendant loses and the government wins, the relator wins, the relator gets a share of the proceeds. And that can range up to 25% or more if the case goes forward and there's a judgment against the defendant.
Now, David, was that the relator's piece of that, does that go back to the Civil War as well?
That's also quite old. In terms of its age. One thing I do want to say, though, about the relator's piece to keep in mind is that the damages under the Civil False Claims Act are treble damages. And so when you've got that multiplier in effect, there's quite a bit more money available then for to be paid out to the relator.
Yeah.
Well, why a relator? What's the sort of public policy purpose of having the ability of private parties, private third parties, to essentially sue on behalf of the federal government? Why is that?
Well, the thought is that oftentimes it's going to be folks inside a company that actually, you know, become aware of these allegations of fraud, become aware of the fraud, and that the government can't afford to hire enough auditors and investigators to investigate everybody. And so they're essentially, through the Key Tam provision of the False Claims Act, they're deputizing private attorneys general, you know, within, you know, throughout the country. To be able to bring these cases, so it's essentially adding to, again, they can't afford to make hire ten times as many lawyers as the Department of Justice, and so this is a way to do that without making the federal outlay.
Well, how does that relate? Where do you see that intersecting with, for example, let's look at one particular contract program, the GSA schedules.
Oh yeah, there's been a lot of activity with the GSA schedules in the False Claims Act arena over the last 6 or 7 years, and all of the cases in that space have been initiated by relators. And the way this case, the way the process works, is that the relator will file his or her case under seal. You know, they'll go to court, they'll file it. They'll file it under seal. No one will know it's been filed. Not even the defendant, many times, almost never, will know that the case, when it's filed, has been filed. Then the government, the Department of Justice, has a period of time. Under the statute, it's 6 months, but they routinely get extensions on that six-month period to conduct an investigation to determine whether the Justice Department will intervene in the case and take the litigation over. And that normally is the relator's goal. Is for the Justice Department to investigate, take the case over, and then litigate the case. The relator stays involved, as a technical matter. The relator is still there. They're still represented by his or her lawyer through the litigation. But the Justice Department is really doing the heavy lifting when it decides to intervene. So the Justice Department will either decide to intervene in the case, take it over, at which point the complaint will be unsealed, and the case will become a matter of public record.
Just a question, Jason or David. David, ask you. Now, so when that happens, when the government begins that investigation, does at that point a contractor, become aware that they're being looked at? How does that work?
Not necessarily. The defendant is not formally notified until the unsealing. Sometimes you can catch wind that there might be some activity ongoing if you see some form of subpoenas or civil investigative demands that are made by the government to the defendant. But for a long period of time, the defendant will be in the dark about what's going on.
And we do have, David, right now we do have to take a break, but when we return, we'll be talking more with Jason Workmaster, partner at McKenna Long & Aldridge, LLP, and David Dowd, partner at Mayer Brown, LLP. And we'll be talking about the Civil False Claims Act. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Government year-end is fast approaching. Look to GSA Advantage and the Han Company now and anytime you're challenged with a compressed time frame or to do more but spend less. Now more than 400 of Han's newest and top models are available online and at great manufacturer direct prices. You'll find multi-purpose chairs, smart desk solutions, durable storage cabinets, contemporary conference tables, and more to fit any office need. All meet or exceed government sustainability requirements, too. To shop Han Direct, go to gsaadvantage.gov and type Han's contract number 27F, like furniture, 0015S, like Sam, in the search bar. That's 27F0015S. When you need office furniture, GSA Advantage is a quick, safe way to buy online, and Han lets you stretch your budget without compromising quality or style. Buy Han Direct. Go to gsaadvantage.gov and search contract 27F0015S today.
For a professional master's degree that will take your career to the next level, the University of Maryland's Master's in Applied Economics can help you gain a valuable professional advantage and expand your career opportunities. Meet faculty and get all your questions answered at the next information session, April 18th at 6:30 p.m. in the Ronald Reagan Building at the Federal Triangle Metro Stop. More details and directions at masters.econ.umd.edu.
I love my husband, but I didn't realize our difficulties had to do with his drinking. Our pastor suggested I go to Al-Anon family groups. I didn't think I would be comfortable, but I decided to try a meeting. The Al-Anon meeting really opened my eyes. Are you troubled by someone's drinking? You might be surprised at what you could learn in an Al-Anon family group meeting from people just like you. Call 1-888-4-Al-Anon.
Arming your home with a security system gives you peace of mind. Now get peace of mind for your wallet. Ackerman Security will monitor your system for $18.95 a month.
I was paying too much for monitoring, so I made the switch to Ackerman Security's Certified Monitoring Center. Now I'm paying only $18.95 a month with no cost to switch.
Call today and get 2 months of Ackerman's award-winning basic monitoring free. 888-999-1070, AckermanSecurity.com.
Many factors affect job satisfaction. Hours, teammates, and opportunity can all make or break an experience. That's why it was an impressive achievement when 100% of employees surveyed recently reported they were proud to work for Acuity Inc. With a 766% growth rate and recognition as a best place to work, Acuity is attracting talented, passionate professionals and keeping them happy. Learn more. Visit myacuity.com/careers.
At Kaiser Permanente, we carefully select our doctors so you can carefully select your doctors. Our hiring process is so selective, only 1 in 10 doctors who apply make the cut. Yes, we're uber picky. Probably have a little perfectionism complex in there. But by putting our doctors under the microscope, we've discovered some of the greatest medical minds in their fields. And that's led to an even greater medical breakthrough. Drumroll, please. Award-winning care. We've received many of the highest possible rankings in member satisfaction, patient safety, overall quality of care, and more. But we're not the only ones reaping the rewards. Because we carefully select our doctors, you have great doctors to choose from. And with all those great doctors, you think it'd be easy. But try choosing just one for your primary care doctor. We'll let you create your own highly selective process for that. We're Kaiser Permanente, and we're here to help you thrive. Visit us at kp.org.
Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of the Mid-Atlantic States Incorporated, 2101 East Jefferson Street, Rockville, Maryland, 20852. It's about smiles. It's about laughter. It's about going out and making a difference in the life of a child. You don't have to get mad. You just have to go mad. GoMad2011.com is a website dedicated to supporting the Make-A-Wish Foundation. At GoMad, our mission is simple, to go out and make a difference. So how can you help? Visit the Wish Wall on GoMad2011.com and make a contribution today. Or find out how you can donate with a simple text message. Do it now so that we can continue to touch the lives of children with life-threatening conditions by granting their wishes.
Rising government leaders are registering now to attend Excellence in Government, the nation's only event focused on helping managers achieve more mission for the money. Here, top officials and thought leaders share transformative new ways of operating, network with peers, and join the conversations which are reshaping government. Join your federal colleagues for Excellence in Government, May 7th in Washington, D.C., to get the ideas you need now to transform your agency, your program, and your career. Register today at excellenceingov.com.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we're talking to Jason Workmaster, a partner at McKenna Long & Aldridge, LLP, and David Dowd, a partner at Mayer Brown, LLP, and we're talking about the Civil False Claims Act. David and Jason are going to be our participants in a forum on the Civil False Claims Act that we're, the Coalition of Government Procurement is going to be holding on April 18th at the Tower Club in Tyson's Corner, breakfast forum. Starting about 8 o'clock, 8:30. So for a two and a half hour session with a host of experts on the Civil False Claims Act. And David, when we took a break, you were talking about, you know, this is because it sort of interests me, this idea that you're being investigated, but you don't know you're being investigated. I don't know how else to say it when you, you know, before it's unsealed. Can you talk a little bit about that again?
Sure. The basic process is that if a relator files an action, the government, as Jason mentioned, is given a period of time in which to investigate the allegations and decide whether or not the government should intervene in the case. Well, in order for the government to do that, the action remains sealed, and it's sealed formally from the defendant, so the defendant does not have any formal notice that the activity is going on. Now, as I mentioned, you know, there are occasions where the defendant might surmise that certain things are happening by virtue of activities that it sees, but it doesn't get the formal notification. The kinds of activities that I mentioned were really two. One is a subpoena that may come either, for example, from GSA or from another source, or what's known as a civil investigative demand, or a CID. And you're starting to see more CIDs used due to a recent change in the law that allows lower-level officials within the Department of Justice to issue them. And those demands, let's start with the CIDs. The CIDs may ask for documents just like a subpoena would, but it also may ask questions in the form of really interrogatories, what we lawyers call interrogatories, and that is basically answer the following question for me. Tell me how you did this or how you do that. And if a company sees or receives a subpoena or a civil investigative demand, I mean, the first question you have to ask yourself is, where is that relator? What is going on? What is the government investigating? There's obviously something out there. And it may be some period of time. As Jason mentioned, you know, the government has 6 months to do it, but extensions are fairly routine. It may be a year or more before you find out whether the government's going to intervene in the action.
Give me a sense here, too, in terms of how often does the government actually decide, well, yeah, we think there's something here, we're going to go forward versus, this isn't worth pursuing. Do you have a sense of how often those things go those different ways?
You know, my sense is that the government, my sense is in the majority of them, the government does not intervene, and oftentimes the case will go away when the government doesn't intervene, and the poor defendant may not even know they were even going to be a defendant. So the government, I do think that because the relator, once the government intervenes, the chance that there will be some kind of settlement, or that it just really changes the calculus when the government intervenes in one of these cases. It changes the calculus for the defendant. It's very different to be litigating against the Justice Department than it is to be litigating against a private relator. The government's aware of that. So even though they do intervene in a good number of cases, you know, you had mentioned the GSA schedule cases. a bit ago, Roger. You know, and the government did end up intervening in a good number of those. Now, are there others out there that are still under seal or that were resolved before they came out from under seal? You know, I just don't know. So over the last, as I said, over the last 6 or 7 years, there's been, you know, half a dozen or slightly more, relatively high-profile cases involving the GSA Schedules program that started with relators bringing the action and the government then, in each of those cases, intervening.
And Jason, what are some of the areas, like just talking about the GSA schedules, what are some of the areas where, you know, folks actually get themselves tied up in knots? I could say something worse, but I don't know.
Well, you know, and it's not surprising. It's the old follow the money, and where these cases, the allegations typically center are on pricing. You know, the initial pricing of the contract when the Commercial Sales Practices Format was submitted,
Tell the folks what that is first.
Sure. You know, in the pricing of a GSA schedule contract, in all the schedule solicitations, there is this form called the Commercial Sales Practices Format, whose intent is the government wants to the contractor, the offeror, to disclose its commercial pricing. And what discounts have you given in the past? What has been your most favored customer pricing? Who's gotten your best pricing in the past? In the past year is typically the standard. And so all of these cases over the last few years have involved an allegation by the relator and then the government that in telling the government about their past commercial history, these contractors somehow said something that was not accurate. And so that's been a focus of these cases. And the other allegation that typically pops up in these cases is that under a schedule contract, once you get the contract, you then have a clause in the contract called the price reductions clause that requires the contractor typically to do some kind of tracking of its commercial pricing on an ongoing basis, so that if something happens to that pricing, if their commercial pricing drops, the government, there may be an argument that the government needs to know about that, and the government may be entitled to some kind of concomitant price reduction. What the allegation that typically pops up in these cases is that the contractor somehow not lived up to that obligation, which has had an effect on the prices it's charged the government. You know, the difference will be, you know, that'll be another typical allegation. Now, what the cases, in my opinion, what these cases, even though you'll have both allegations, you know, fraud in the initial pricing, fraud in following the price reductions clause, these cases, in my opinion, tend to focus on the initial pricing. And the reason for that is, you know, David was mentioning the treble damages component of the False Claims Act. You know, it's not just single damages. It's not just how much the government was actually harmed. You take that amount of harm and you multiply it by 3 in calculating how much the government's going to get. And if you can make an allegation, if a relator or the government can make an allegation that the contract was awarded from the get-go as the result of fraud, you know, the relators.
It's just a bigger number, right?
It's a bigger number,
right? I can figure that out.
Oh yeah, it's a bigger number, and so these cases tend to gravitate in that direction. And you know, there's even an argument that, well, if you hadn't lied up at the front, you wouldn't have made a dollar. So we'll just take every single dollar that you've made and multiply it by 3. So you know, and that's where these cases start to get really scary for defendants.
And how does, you know, is it each invoice, is that the way?
Well, that's a great question, Roger. I mean, it's something that's actually still an open issue as to exactly how you calculate penalties when you have an argument that the contract itself was awarded as the result of fraud, because it is the False Claims Act, and so liability attaches to the submission of a claim, and a claim is a request for money. And so that's really what the liability attaches to, is the submission of your invoice asking for payment when it's false. There's this argument that if you lie to get the contract, well, then that means every single invoice you submitted is ipso facto a false claim. And not only, this is the other troubling part of the False Claims Act. Not only does the government get treble damages, but it gets there's a statutory penalty that attaches to each false claim, and that can range up to $11,000 per claim. Well, if you have a GSA schedule contract where over the course of 5, 10, 15 years, you've submitted a few thousand invoices, an argument could be made, and the cases are unclear on that.
Yeah.
How you would calculate penalties in that situation before you even get to damages.
Yeah. Well, you know what's clear right now, Jason, is I'm going to have to take a break. And I know you have to. You're going to be leaving the show, and we're going to continue our conversation with David Dowd. So I want to thank you for being on the show today, and I look forward to your participation in the Civil False Claims Act Forum on April 18th. Jason, it's great to have you on. And when we come back, we'll be talking to David Dowd from Ayer Brown LLP about the Civil False Claims Act. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Government year-end is fast approaching. Look to GSA Advantage and the Hahn Company now and anytime you're challenged with a compressed time frame or to do more but spend less. Now more than 400 of Hahn's newest and top models are available online and at great manufacturer direct prices. You'll find multi-purpose chairs, smart desk solutions, durable storage cabinets, contemporary conference tables, and more to fit any office need. All meet or exceed government sustainability requirements, too. To shop Hahn Direct, go to gsaadvantage.gov and type Hahn's contract number 27F, like furniture, 0015S, like Sam, in the search bar. That's 27F0015S. When you need office furniture, GSA Advantage is a quick, safe way to buy online, and Hahn lets you stretch your budget without compromising quality or style. Buy Hahn Direct. Go to gsaadvantage.gov and search contract 27F0015S today.
Inova Fairfax Hospital for Children is Northern Virginia's only children's hospital, providing extra special care for our region's littlest patients. Each day, they help premature babies thrive, cure the tiniest of hearts, and beat childhood cancers. Help Inova heal our region's children. Join the Inova Fairfax Hospital for Children at the Star Kid 8K on April 22nd. Proceeds support Inova's pediatric heart programs. To learn more and register, go to inova.org/8K.
Diary entry, August 15th. My joints ache. Today I can hardly move. I need some answers.
September 3rd. I'm tired all the time.
What's going on? June 8th. I woke up with a rash on my face. I want to know why.
For answers, ask your doctor the right question. Could I have lupus? For answers, for support, for hope, visit couldihavelupus.gov or call 1-800-994-9662. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office on Women's Health and the Ad Council.
And now the Federal Living Report, brought to you by WEPA.
The Federal Employees Health Benefits Program is expanding members' access to experimental drugs. It's going to require insurers to cover participation in certain clinical trials next year. The Office of Personnel Management says those trials will include federally funded research into prevention, detection, and treatment of cancer and other life-threatening diseases. The federal program is getting a head start on legal mandates that kick in 2014.
These are hard times for federal employees. A multi-year pay freeze, rumors of furloughs, and discussions on reducing benefits are the realities that all federal employees face. Now, more than ever, it's important to find ways to save your hard-earned money. One way is with life insurance from WEPA. WEPA offers lower rates and a premium refund policy that's returned over $58 million to its policyholders since 1996. To learn how much you can save, visit WAEPA.org. Once again, that's WAEPA.org.
Engineering, information technology, and intelligence professionals. When you are powered by innovation and guided by integrity, everything is possible. We invite you to explore a future with the largest provider of IT services, systems integration, and training to the U.S. government. Lockheed Martin will be attending several job fair events the rest of this month in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. Stop by our booth to discuss opportunities available with programs in a number of D.C. metro locations and overseas. We are seeking cleared individuals with expertise in engineering, information technology, and intelligence analysis. For details on these opportunities and our events, or to chat live with one of our recruiters, visit www.lockheedmartinjobs.com/WTOP and click on events. Everything is possible with Lockheed Martin.
Remember, visit www.lockheedmartinjobs.com/WTOP and click on events. Lockheed Martin is an equal opportunity employer.
Hi, this is Wayne Zell, host of Blueprint for Wealth, every week here at 10 a.m. on 1500 a.m. Please join me this week for my special guest, Jeremy Farber, president of PC Recycler. Blueprint for Wealth is brought to you by the law firm of Odin, Feldman & Pittleman, a full-service firm located in Fairfax, Virginia, serving the entire Washington, D.C. metro area. If you'd like to know more about our firm, visit us on the web at www.ofplaw.com.
Our brains all look pretty much the same from the outside. To truly understand what makes each one different, a quest is on to reverse engineer our most complex organ. A unique personality is somehow programmed into your brain. Sebastian Sung, a computational neuroscientist at MIT, is trying to decipher the way that happens and how personal memories are made.
One very important hypothesis is that the information in your memories is somehow encoded in the connectome, that unique map of your brain's connections.
Sung says a connectome looks like an airline flight map, but
for your brain, it would have to be 100 billion cities and 10,000 flights emanating from every city.
Connecting those dots is a massive job, but Sung is engineering techniques to do it, both in his lab and on a website asking the public for help called iWire. That's eyewire.org. More at www.nae.edu/radio. With the National Academy of Engineering, Randy Atkins, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my continuing guest is David Dowd from Mayer Brown LLP. Jason Workmaster from McKenna Long and Aldridge was kind enough to join us for the first part of the discussion on the Civil False Claims Act. And David, when we took the break from the last segment, Jason was talking about the price reduction clause and the submission of commercial sales practices format and how those potential are areas of potential Civil False Claims Act liability, depending on what happens. Are there other areas involving contracts in general, the GSA schedules, that, Civil False Claims Act issues do come up?
Yes, there are. There are two other really primary areas that you see False Claims Act allegations in the context of a schedule program that I did want to mention. Before I say that, though, a schedule contract is a government contract, which includes a variety of clauses in it. So really, in addition to the four that Jason and I have been talking about, or we'll be talking about, there are a variety of other clauses that a contractor allegedly could violate that could lead to False Claims Act liability. That would be common among all government contracts. But the two areas I did want to mention, in addition to what Jason talked about, were first the Trade Agreements Act, and then second, an area that we commonly refer to as labor qualifications.
And these are actually, David, these are a couple areas actually that are common to all. The Trade Agreements Act applies to all contracts over the Trade Agreements Act threshold, which I think is, correct me, 204,000.
I think that's right. Yeah.
Something like that. And then labor qualifications.
It's common in any services contract. Yeah. Can be common in any services contract. You tend to see more activity on the schedules program in part because of the dollars that flow through those. But yes, this is an area where a schedule contractor could be liable, just like another type of government contractor could be liable. The Trade Agreements Act, in short, provides that the government may only buy products or services from certain designated countries. And there's a lengthy list, which changes from time to time, of the countries that are eligible. And by implication, countries that are not listed are ineligible. And so one of the requirements that's imposed on schedule contractors and other contractors is to identify in the offer that's made to the government those products or items that are provided from a non-designated country. So let's take, for example, you're going to sell a keyboard to the government, and that keyboard is not made in an eligible country. You have to advise the government of that fact, and then the government can then is able to make a determination that the product, the keyboard at issue here, is not available from a qualifying country, and therefore the purchase can proceed. But in order to make that determination, the government has to be advised that the product is foreign in origin, as we typically call it. And that's an area that has been ripe for litigation under the False Claims Act involving the schedule program. Over the last 5 or 6 years, the cases were back to 2007, 2008, really, that tipped all this off. But there have been a wide variety of cases filed by relators claiming that products that are listed on the schedule or on a schedule contract are not from a qualifying country. And some of these claims have been made by people who worked in the industry, and others have been made by people who have some general familiarity with the products but don't necessarily work in the industry. So the source of the relator for those kinds of claims has been very interesting. They have often been from outside the company and maybe even quite far away from the company. Another area, just to touch on briefly, is this area of labor qualifications. And the basic issue there is called out in a schedule contract, and as you note in any other government contract, where there are services being provided, there can be qualifications listed for personnel. So if, let's say, for example, a senior programming engineer will have certain qualifications. A claim is sometimes made under the False Claims Act, Civil False Claims Act, that the person that was tasked to perform the work under a task order under the GSA schedule does not have the requisite qualifications that are called out in the contract. And therefore, the claim for payment for the senior programming engineer, to use our example, is false because the person lacks the requisite qualifications. And so you do see that area, I guess, in addition to the three others that we talked about, really presenting the major challenge in the context of GSA schedules.
So, in with regard to the Trade Agreements Act, I mean, it seems to me that's you have a substantial transformation test, right, to determine country of origin, and that test is really very subjective. It's very facts specific. It seems to me. So that's an area where when a company's looking at whether they're going to offer a product or not. I mean, what's the process they go through when they think? Do they look at the terms of the RFP, which defines what the item is in and of itself, because some things are bundled together, and then doing an analysis? What do they go through?
What are the steps there? It's a pretty complex process, I would say. I mean, first you look at the RFP to see how it defines what the item is, what the end item that's being sold is. And perhaps the end item is a larger composite, such that the keyboard in our example maybe is not being sold itself. Instead, there's a home or a computer system being sold, and one component of that is the keyboard, but the end item is the system as a whole, and therefore you look at it in that light. Other times you'll see RFPs call out items like spares, or allow for the separate provision in procurement of the keyboard in our example, in which case, then in that case, the keyboard may well be the end item that's being sought. In terms of what companies do then to check compliance, it's a multi-step process. There certainly is the question of the substantial transformation test. Is that item substantially transformed in a designated country such that it's eligible for purchase? In making that determination, you have to find out a number of things. First of all, where are all the pieces coming from? What are the various components? Where does substantial transformation occur? Which can be complex. Another area of particular complexity, I think, for the schedule program, which relies on commercial items, is that sometimes the place of origin changes. Let's say you've got your keyboard in our example, and the keyboard is made in the United Kingdom. So it's a qualifying country. All is well. The company gets that information, determines that it's an eligible product, and there you go forward. Well, over time, your supplier, who previously was in the United Kingdom, has relocated production and is now making the product somewhere else, for example, in China, which wouldn't be a qualifying country. Now suddenly there's a problem. But how does the company ensure compliance when they're buying products every day and supplying products every day, and the underlying contract is a 5-year contract? It's a very complex process to make sure that the products you're buying are compliant each and every day that they're sold.
Yeah, and with regard to the turning to the services aspect of it and labor qualifications, and if you used someone who didn't meet the qualifications, but the result of the service was still exemplary and you did a good job, that's not going to really matter, is it?
No, it's not going to matter. It's not going to be a defense to the liability under the act. It may offer some hope of convincing the government that perhaps they shouldn't stick with the action, but ultimately, if the person does not meet the labor qualifications, there's going to be a problem. I think
because the government's going to look at that as like you overpriced it, or the government pay too much for this,
right?
Because the person didn't meet it,
right? The underlying theory is with our senior programming engineer that he or she had to have certain academic qualifications as well as years of experience. you then were able, and the price was set for that, and you were then able to submit or use a lower skilled person, therefore lower paid person, and charge the higher rate. Therefore, you benefited by defrauding the government from the additional capability of that more skilled person. You know, one of the areas of compliance that, you know, I see in this is sometimes, you know, with companies, you know, people, as they're with the company over time, you know, they obviously acquire experience and capability they didn't have before. And a lot of times when these issues arise, the question is, I mean, look at the person's resume. You know, the resume just may not be updated. And now you're, after the fact, trying to convince somebody, well, you know, the person really did have that qualification, even though we, the company, didn't qualify, you know, didn't categorize them as the senior programming engineer in our official records.
Right. Well, that's almost like a situation, right, where it turns out after the fact the person met the qualifications, but, you know, the resume didn't reflect it.
Right.
At the time. So it looks like you didn't even look anyway, right?
Right, right. And that's the challenge, I think, with labor qualifications. A lot of times they are the right people being used, but there's just some, you know, gap in the process of, you know, when is that resume updated?
And speaking, hey, gaps, we got to, hey, David, we have to take a gap now. We have to take a break. But when we return, we'll be talking more with David Dowd, a partner at Mayer Brown LLP, and we're talking about the Civil False Claims Act. And last segment, we'll talk a bit more about compliance and the importance of it. And as you've heard from the last three segments, how important it is. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
If you are facing advanced illness or the end of life of a loved one, peace of mind is in short supply. Fortunately, pain-free comfort care is available from the Washington Home and Community Hospices, a not-for-profit organization with a holistic team of doctors, nurses, caregivers, social workers, chaplains, and volunteers. The team comes to you in your home or wherever you call home in D.C., Montgomery, or Prince George's County. For your peace of mind, call them day or night for a complimentary consultation at 866-234-7742.
Hey kids, I'm Les Stroud, aka Survivor Man, and I invite you to enter the Get to Know contest.
Create artwork, writing, photos, videos, or music celebrating your wild neighbors. Get outdoors, get creative, and you could win some wild prizes, including having your work published in the Get to Know contest calendar. Enter by July 16th at gettoknow.ca. That's gettoknow.ca.
The Get to Know contest. More info at gettoknow.ca.
Here's Dr. Robert Norris, Chief Architect of the NGA, on the Federal Executive Forum on Big Data, sponsored by GDIT.
We've talked about how big data is so huge in volume. We need to think about who's using the information, how often has it been accessed, and when should it actually roll off the systems and be archived so that we don't have huge big data instead of just big data.
To listen to the whole program made possible by Trezza Media Group, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
Today's data-driven environment requires a sophisticated framework and advanced analytics to turn massive amounts of structured and unstructured data into actionable information. General Dynamics Information Technology looks beyond basic big data approaches and provides solutions tailored to the unique needs of defense, intelligence, and federal civilian organizations. General Dynamics Information Technology, dedicated to solving big data integration problems in any domain. For more information, visit GDIT.com.
What is the information technology strategy for the U.S. National Nuclear Security Administration? How is the NNSA modernizing its technology infrastructure and ensuring its IT investments align with its overall mission? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these questions and so much more with Bob Osborne, Chief Information Officer at the National Nuclear Security Administration, next week on the Business of Government Hour.
I'm Beyonce with an important message about hunger in America. Did you know 1 in 8 people struggle with hunger? Over 12 million children live in homes where there isn't always enough food. Food banks are experiencing more demand than ever. Show Your Helping Hand is a nationwide campaign with the goal of helping Feeding America deliver millions of meals to local food banks. Please join me in showing a helping hand to fight hunger. More information is available at showyourhelpinghand.com.
Here's an inspiring story provided by Insperity.
Hi, I'm Tony Sterling, Vice President of Project Support Services Incorporated, a service-disabled veteran-owned small business. We provide project and contract support services to federal, state, and local government. I wear many hats in my job, as I'm sure most of you do, in small and mid-market companies. In 2008, we had only 46 employees. Now, thanks to Insperity's diverse spectrum of services, we have 156 employees and a true national footprint. One of the keys to our rapid growth is Insperity. They give us the resources of a large corporation in areas like HR, payroll, recruiting, training, and consulting on compliance issues. It's comforting to know that we have Insperity in our corner.
Insperity understands the many challenges faced by the federal contracting community. You need the right resources to give you the competitive advantage. Insperity's multi-state infrastructure gives you big company resources without compromising your status. Call 800-465-3800 or visit Insperity.com. Insperity, inspiring business performance.
The Washington Business Journal is seeking nominations for its sixth annual CFO of the Year Awards, recognizing CFOs and other financial executives in the Washington area for their outstanding performance as corporate financial stewards. Are you or someone you know a CFO star? Nominate them online at WashingtonBusinessJournal.com/nomination. Deadline is fast approaching. Save the date for the award ceremony, Thursday, July 19th at the Omni Shoreham Hotel.
Listen each week for Tech Tuesday on Federal News Radio. Every Tuesday, we zero in on how technology inspires innovation. Tuesday mornings at 11, it's Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy, the latest on products that help bring policy to life. Then Tuesday afternoons at 12:30, join Federal News Radio's Jason Miller for Ask the CIO. Hear from the top of the food chain on how your agency is using technology today. Tech Tuesday, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, we have been talking to Jason Workmaster from McKenna Long and Aldridge LLP and David Dowd from Mayer Brown LLP. And David's still with us. And David, when we took a break, we were talking about the services issue and reviewing resumes and that sort of thing and how that could feed into Civil False Claims Act issues for labor qualifications. And that just sort of leads to the next sort of, to me, logical question, because we touched on it a bit, but the Trade Agreements Act as well, and that's the importance of compliance and what that is and what does that mean for government contractors. It seems to me it's a fundamental, if you're going to be in the federal space, compliance is a fundamental investment you have to make before you even begin to decide what kind of business you're going after in the federal space.
That's absolutely right. Certainly, in the schedules context, that's true. It's true in all contexts. And I, my experience, government contractors do that. Certainly, good government contractors do that quite well. The major issues for compliance in the schedule area, and the need to have a compliance program, really do focus, I think, Jason mentioned, in terms of pricing, on some of the pricing aspects. And in that regard, the price reductions clause is really the major area. Does the company have in place a robust enough program that the company can identify any instances in which they've granted a discount greater than the amount that the contract was predicated upon? Can you see that in fairly near real time? And can you, as you're required to by contract, notify the government of that fact such that fact can be addressed? That is a key challenge, compliance challenge for any contractor, schedules contractor. Another challenge compliance-wise, and it happens less frequently, but when it comes time to submit a CSP, a commercial sales practice format, or to update one, do you have the requisite systems in place that you can identify the extent to which your practices have changed over time, or that you've started to offer different sorts of discounts to different categories of customer than maybe you had previously? And hopefully you can see that before your CSP has to go in. Trade Agreements Act, we've talked about compliance programs there. In the labor qualifications area, the compliance challenge is to make sure that the resumes, and the people that underlie those resumes that you use, in fact, meet whatever qualifications were called out in the schedule contract. And to make sure that the same people are being categorized the correct way if you have different contract vehicles. Sometimes you'll see in a schedules contract context, somebody's characterized as a senior program engineer, and then they've got a very different labor qualification in another context. And that sort of raises a flag as to whether or not that person's correctly categorized in one or the other. So it's very important to put together a compliance program on paper, certainly. But it's also important that the people understand that compliance program. I mean, a paper compliance program that the people don't have the ability to work and really understand doesn't do you a whole lot of good. I mean, you want to be able to tell the government if the government decides to intervene, look, you know, whatever mistake happened here is not likely to be repeated. We've got a robust plan in place to take care of it. But you also want to show the government while you're saying all that, that the people do get the training that they need, and that whatever mistake
you have, hotlines, all those kind of things, right?
You have to have a hotline. You have to have a compliance officer that's designated. You have to show, have the ability to show that whenever a complaint is brought to the hotline, it is promptly investigated and there's follow-up. It's important, I think, also to let the person, to the extent you do know who's raising a concern with a hotline or something like that, or the person's raising a concern by name, that there's follow-up to that person to let them know whatever happened with that investigation. And if you
right, because
that,
that's where you get the issues where you get, you know, QTAM suits, right?
Yeah,
people
a lot of times,
ignore, somebody calls the hotline and feels like it's been ignored, that they've pushed under the rug or something.
Right, and that's a big concern, you know, the follow-up. You know, you may well do the investigation, then find out that, well, you know, the person who brought raised the complaint didn't know that something had been investigated. I mean, a lot of times the relators, at least when they're within the company, are frustrated employees, somebody who think, you know, they think they've brought the concern to somebody's attention. It's a problem, but no action's been taken on it. And in fact, there may have been action taken on it.
Just didn't follow through with the person, right?
Right.
How does a mandatory disclosure, requirements, the clause, does it play with the compliance programs?
It does. It now requires for contractors of a certain size, you know, with $5 million of business, they're going to have an ethics and compliance policy in place, in effect, and that has to be a meaningful policy. So, you know, every contractor has to have that, you know, of any substance, has to have that kind of policy in place.
That's something that somebody should have anyway as good business, but now it's sort of contractually
required. Yeah, now
it's required.
Now there's a basis for the government to say, well, you know, show me what it is, and there are certain expectations as to how it would look. But it's always a good, you mentioned an investment, I think that's the right word. I mean, investing in a policy like that and having a robust policy, it's good for business. It avoids what could be very bad business, and that is, you know, some liability under the Civil False Claims Act.
Right. And so David, we're going to, the Coalition for Government Procurement's going to be hosting this Civil False Claims Act forum at the Tower Club, April 18th, 8:30. And we've got a panel, Chris Mead, Relators Council from London and Mead, yourself, Jason Workmaster, and Jack Horan from McKenna Long and Aldridge, and Marsha Mattson, and hopefully somebody from the Department of Justice to talk about their perspective on these things. What are people going to see when they
Sure. We're probably going to break it down into two pieces. First, we're going to talk a bit more than we've been able to talk today about the kinds of issues that contractors face under the Civil False Claims Act. You know, what are the major compliance challenges? What are the areas that can lead to a Civil False Claims Act case? And we'll touch on that in some degree. And then we want to walk through the basic process and give folks a chance to hear from some people who've done this for quite a number of years, and also to ask questions, things that, of interest to them, whether it's to Relators Council or Government Council or outside counsel, and to talk about, what is it like for a case to arise? You know, how does a relator come to be? How does that relator come into his or her lawyer's office and talk about bringing an action against some company? What does the Department of Justice do when they hear about an action? You know, again, the action is sealed if it's brought by a relator. So the government hears before the defendant, the would-be defendant hears. What's the process that the government goes through to decide whether to intervene? And then, okay, the bad news finally hits the company that they've been the subject of some investigation. What does the company do? And among the things that we're going to cover are, what, as far as companies go, what strategies would you employ once you find out about that there's an investigation under the Civil False Claims Act? I mean, many companies want to get a handle on things. They want to go in and meet with the government, tell the government what the answer to the ultimate question is, and see if there can be some resolution of it. A lot of times the company wants to do that as facts are still being gathered. I mean, the government's been gathering facts for a while. The relator's been on it even longer. And the company's really just finding out about this action and very much in react mode, but wants to be as proactive as possible. And we're going to talk about that, about, what are the strategies for dealing with that? How might you go in and talk to the government? What do you need to know before you do that?
Right. Well, it sounds like a really interesting forum. I'm looking forward to it. And David, I want to thank you for joining me on the show today. And also I want to thank my other guest, Jason Workmaster from McKenna Long and Aldridge, for joining me, talking about the Civil False Claims Act, some of the key issues facing GSA schedule contractors, as well as some tips on compliance. And I'm Roger Waldron, and you're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, Tuesday mornings at 10:30 only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.